communities in which we serve.
And thank you for those stories. They're more than mere stories. They're powerful narratives that empower us. We're approaching the midpoint of our show. I started to say, as you talked about empowerment, we believe here at WPFW to empower our listeners, our world, one broadcast at a time. In order to do that, we, at our halfway point, provide public service announcements. But before we go to them, I just want to reintroduce you. We're talking to Dr. Vidette Coleman Robinson. She's the president and CEO of the Association of African American Museums, commonly referred to as AAAM. We're talking about Black museums, their importance to us folks, to everyone. And you're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. Won't you stick with us as we take a short break, and we'll be right back after this.
On Sunday, October 6th, 9 a.m. until midnight, WPFW present De Colores, celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month. Our beloved Sunday programmers will explore the rich musical palette of Latinx artists, from the strings of Villa Lobos to Salsera Graciela, to the Cuban jazz and electronic sounds of Omar Sosa. That De Colores, celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month on WPFW. Building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
David.
Oh, you're welcome. And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. But as I always say, more importantly, our guest and topic, Dr. Vidette Coleman Robinson, President and CEO of the Association of African American Museums, AAAM, is here talking with us about Black museums in our society throughout our country, why they're important, their history, their stories. They're energizing and empowering context for us all. Doctor, again, thank you so much for having us talk to you today.
Absolutely.
There's still more stories to be told. Again, you've given a good demonstration how museums are not these staid, set in place institutions. They're not fortresses, they're not castles, they're locations that are open to everyone. And I was thinking about a number of things that were mentioned throughout the conference. One of them was the retelling of the story of Ronald McNair, an NASA astronaut that was lost to us in the tragedy of the space shuttle explosion. Ronald McNair was turned away as a youth from a public library. Mm-hmm. And still had the engine, the drive, the spirit to pursue the sciences. And now in Lake City, South Carolina, there's the Ronald McNair Life Center, and now every child has a library. What a wonderful story.
Amazing.
And you talked earlier before we took the break about, the contemporary efforts to establish the National Museum of African American History and Culture.
Yes.
But I want to join you in possibly reminding folks, you know, immediately after the Civil War, there were national conventions of Black folk. There were cultural leaders, and they advocated then for a national museum. How in the world, you know, after escaping enslavement, still dealing with the Nader after Reconstruction, the subsequent snap-in of Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. How have we persisted decade after decade for more than a century to establish a museum? And the problem also was there were cultural forces against these efforts. Yeah. And somehow, somewhere in the Congress, I believe in the Senate, there was a suggestion of a museum, and they actually wanted to have a giant mammy statue as part of the museum. It's just incredible that people are so disrespectful and exercise denial on that. Mm-hmm. So here we go. Maybe the best thing to do after telling that story and talking too long is just to talk about some of the themes that were at the conference. You made it clear that museums further self-determination. What are some of the other things that when you all conference together that you try to cover and establish?
Oh, well, you know, we always do our call for proposals. And obviously this year was very, we had to talk about the Civil Rights Act and commemorate the Civil Rights Act. And furthermore, you know, as a child of hip hop, it was the 1995 Source Awards, where Andre 3000 said, the South has something to say. Well, you know, while we were planning this year's conference last year and throughout this year, you know, Maryland is below the Mason-Dixon line. And we wanted to make sure that Marylanders who, you know, through blood, sweat, and tears were being uplifted. We wanted to make sure that people did not forget Thurgood Marshall and what he did to make sure that, you know, the Civil Rights Act was pushed through. And also, you know, we didn't want to forget how Pauli Murray and Thurgood Marshall down at Howard, you know, we're doing Brown versus Board of Education and writing that. We just didn't want any, you know, I'm not saying that our members forgot, because they're always, you know, making sure that these narratives are being preserved, but we wanted to uplift and say their names. So it was just very important for us to make sure that the programming for this conference literally uplifted every Marylander, every African-American Marylander who had anything to do with the freedoms that we have today. You know, we wanted to make sure that they had a voice, which was also why we made certain that the opening plenary had Dr. Carla Hayden, who is the librarian of the Library of Congress, the first African-American, but she also, you know, helped turn Enoch Pratt Library completely around. It's one of my favorite libraries in the country. I haven't gone to much, but I've only been to the ones in which are in my neighborhood. But I can tell you, in the places that I've lived, the Enoch Pratt Library system is by far, it makes you feel like you are, like that is your home. And like you belong.
One of the charms of Baltimore, I dare say.
I know, Charm City. I never got it when I first moved out here, but now I understand. And then also, you know, we made sure that the Thursday plenary was curated by Morgan State so that we could have several iterations of folks who were in protest movements to make sure that we had civil liberties and freedoms, you know, speak about their experiences. And one of the gentlemen, Mr. Dunneville, actually was in the room when Thurgood Marshall was defending Brown versus Board of Education. So we were thankful to have him. How he even got there is his professor at Morgan State University took the whole class down there. So we wanted his story told and encapsulized for conference. And then, you know, we were very blessed to have Maryland's First Lady, Dawn Moore, speak about her experiences and even getting into that role. And it was just, you know.
Yeah, and she spoke about a larger issue of culture, how it's politically and culturally relevant and how it's important to us Black folk, but it really is serving everyone. And that doesn't have to be the justification for it, because we're part of communities. But she gave a really, she sat down with us for a good hour and a half and talked about that.
Yeah, she was amazing. And, you know, but that's what our conferences are about. We have kumbaya moments. Sometimes we're crying in sessions because, you know, the stuff, You know, David, the things that we deal with on a daily basis as African Americans, it's hard. But when you are preserving this history and culture, you know, sometimes the things that you are dealing with on a day-to-day basis are re-traumatizing. You're living, you know, other people's trauma, and then you have to interpret it in a way that speaks to the masses. And then also in there somewhere you have to, you know, travel back in time, like back to the future, and figure out, you know, how you're going to show up for your family and your friends after dealing with all of that. So our conferences allow everybody a moment to breathe and a moment to just reconnect with themselves and their colleagues. And again, it's still iron sharpening iron, which is, you know, are always our foremost thought. And then this year we did something we included our STEM related colleagues. So we had, you know, some folks from science centers present this year about, because how could you not talk about, you know, Benjamin Banneker and, you know, some of the other folks who are scientists and things of that nature, you know, the astronaut that you mentioned earlier. There's just, you can't get away from the things that African-Americans have done. One of the things that I mentioned in passing with one of our members during conference is they said, you know, Vedette, I'm just baffled that now we have STEAM people here. It's just so beautiful. I said, well, you know, when they stole us from Africa, we were STEAM. We were engineers. We were doing all the things. So why wouldn't we have that representation here at conference? And it was just, you know, it was like kind of like a full circle moment. So if anybody had something, you know, not that anybody did, but if anybody had a critique or ridicule about why in a cultural space we're bringing, you know, science and technology centers in, that's the reason why, because we want to make sure that their voices are being heard as well. So yeah, that when we are planning for conference, we curate an experience to make sure that our members are heard and they're in a safe environment to have conversations about what they're dealing with. One of the things that I always think about is when I first joined AAAM in 2005, I heard a story in which somebody said, you know, I'm working and people come in that don't look like us. And they say things like, you know, if this were the 1800s, you would be my slave. And you're like, oh my gosh. And you still have to, you know, you have to dig deep and still work and do a tour after that. Right. But that's still happening today. Those narratives
how are unfortunate. It's really
very
sad.
Unfortunate. It's very unfortunate. But yeah, so, you know, so again, that's why our conferences are so important, because it gives everybody a moment to just breathe and be themselves and be in community.
Well, you mentioned a number of things, and I want to just catch them. You talked about the goodwill, the good flourishing, the good faith that was present at the conference, and therefore present in each and every one of the museums that are represented, their staff, and importantly, the people who attend. When you said a kumbaya moment, I just want to remind listeners that that's from African culture, and it's come by here, Lord, join mm-hmm. together with us, support us, sustain us, preserve us. So we don't use that term lightly, and certainly you didn't in that regard. We're going to move from not only paying attention to Maryland and Baltimore, but to other parts of the country. But I did want to say that the two museums that I mentioned that are in Baltimore, the Reginald Lewis Museum and the National Blacks and Wax Museum, were very present and a helpful host and complement to having you in Baltimore. Yeah. But I also wanted to mention that Morgan State was responsible. We mentioned Lily Carol Jackson before, again, head of the Baltimore NAACP branch and a longtime Maryland State Senator. When she transitioned, she wanted her home to be turned into a museum, and Morgan State was responsible for the caretaking of that. And I believe there's going to be kind of a refreshment or a renewal or re- reopening of that effort some way, somehow. And that's important. She, as well as these other people, these other places, these other institutions we're mentioning, epitomize not an isolated individual effort, but a collective effort of our community.
Correct.
You keep mentioning how society interacts and plays a role as Black museums have evolved. Let us do a couple of things here. Recognizing that Black museums are the result of social struggle, the efforts of Black radio, the efforts of the Black Panthers Party in Oakland. In fact, there's a Black Panther Party museum in Oakland. There's a new international museum regarding African-Americans in America in Charleston. There's the in my hometown of New York, the Louis Armstrong Museum, situated in Corona, Queens, New York. There are countless places that we can mention over and over. And to prevent me from talking too much further, I like the fact that you're talking about living true to life, life activity examples in museums. One of the highlights at the conference was the commemorative efforts for the Harriet Jacobs Project site in Eatonton, North Carolina. Yeah. So I've mentioned and I've offered up a number of touch points for you. Again, let's go further in talking about the lively relationships these institutions and the people who work at them represent.
Yeah, you know, I can't, I would be remiss if I did not speak about, you know, the one thing that we wanted to make sure when we came to this conference is that we also included the HBCUs in Maryland. So Morgan State and Coppin State, which are two of the HBCUs in Baltimore, had a tremendous influence on what we were doing. They were super partners. We had the president of Coppin State University interview, Dr. Carla Hayden on that first day on Wednesday, and that was absolutely beautiful. And then we closed out that reception on Wednesday evening at Morgan State University with Sweet Honey and the Rock performing. And it was just, you know, it set the tone for what we needed.
Since you mentioned Sweet Honey and the Rock, one quick interjection. Dr. Bernice Reagan was the apex, the zenith of being the educator activist. And this wonderful woman would just connect with us so dearly. She had so much respect in individual conversations and talking to groups and encouraging performance artists. She lived what you're talking about. And I pardon the interruption. Just want to acknowledge that.
And she was a member. You know, that's the thing that's important also to note. It just set the tone for what we needed, and it also showed our members. Now we had some folks from Bowie come to conference, and I think a couple of people from UMass, University of Maryland Eastern Shore, also attended. And obviously, I shouldn't say obviously, but we did have some folks from Howard come, and I say obviously because I went there for my master's and my PhD. So we had a lot of folks join us, and I think there may have been a couple of sessions where students were speaking, but that's also the beauty of AAAM. You know, since the dawn of time, we've been an organization that has given people opportunities to speak. I cannot remember a AAAM trying to break into this field where it was so pretentious and people weren't allowing you to come and speak to them about any and everything that you wanted to. Like, I remember going to conferences and Margaret Burroughs passing us stuff, right? You would think that somebody who's a founder would, you know, kind of shy away, but that was not the tone that they were doing.
You know, that's such a good remark. let me capitalize on it. But first, I will reintroduce you. We're talking to Dr. Vidette Coleman Robinson, the president and CEO of the Association of African American Museums, AAAM. We're obviously talking about Black museums this morning. We're in the closing quarter of our program, Doctor. So here's my housework. Yeah. We are thankful that listeners choose to support us in our entirety. There are over 80 programmers that put public affairs and music programming on different social media platforms, including our own archives at wpfwfm.org. But also my friend and colleague, host Muiza Mutale of Africa Now, which is broadcast on Wednesdays, 1 p.m. Eastern, which covers people of African descent, not only in the continent, but throughout the world, can be found on SoundCloud. And we can be found, many of the shows can be found on iTunes. And it's all because you, the listener, throughout the year may click that bright red donate button again at wpfwfm.org, or you may select a show on Cash App, $WPFWFM, include all that, WPFWFM with a dollar sign in front of it. And that is the shameless promotion of why we here and exist for 47 plus years, Doctor. That's why we're here. People, even as far as Baltimore, out into West Virginia, to the Eastern Shore, down into Northern Virginia, and throughout the world on the internet, choose to support us. I would say also coming up next, right after this program in the news, don't forget the Blues, the Wednesday edition with Clarence the Blues Man Turner. And if we're backing up from the early afternoon, 3 to 5, Sophie's Parlor, Music and Culture by Women for Everyone, by one of the oldest established women's collectives that is are on public broadcasting. At 2, Shai Wanana, covering Middle Eastern affairs with Zena El Amin, is also there. Doctor, let's proceed. We've got still quite a bit to cover with just a few minutes to go. Let's talk about the future. You mentioned how HBCUs can play an important role. Many of those institutions train certain majors in museum management and about museums and about culture. We've got some new museums coming, the Juneteenth Museum in Fort Worth, Texas, I believe in 2026. Yes. The Lucas Museum after George Lucas, and I'm having a mental block on his philanthropist wife, who is a major financial venture capitalist and investor, but the Lucas Museum of Narrative Art in Los Angeles is coming. And you mentioned the call for proposals. What's the future looking like?
Well, the future of Black museums, as far as I'm concerned, is pretty strong. I haven't seen anybody, kind of slowing down ever. We did have some museums that closed during COVID. They had to close their doors, but what they wound up doing was pivoting over to a virtual museum and a virtual space. And to me, that just shows you. And then we have museums that are starting off virtual and want to remain virtual for the dawn of time, just to make sure that their collections are available to all. So they are using, the Oculus and the Apple Pro goggles and things like that. And I'm sure that there's other things out there, but they're starting there because they want to do low cost, no cost. So I just look at our museums and I just know that the future of Black museums are bright. There is no slowing down. Folks have, my members have this tenacity and this mentality that nothing's going to stop them from telling the truth, which is, sometimes I have interviews and, people say, well, with the banning of books, what do you expect from your Black museums? And I'm like, I expect them to continue to do what they've been doing, which is telling the truth.
And to have exhibits and those things that are banned and challenged, right?
Yes. You know, it's just, we tell the truth. And, there was a study, done about, you know, do you trust, what do you trust the most? Where do you get your information, your history from, and what do you trust the most? And do you know that museums are trusted over family members and also,
my goodness,
and the news. So if that's the case, you know, we fall right in there, because the one thing that we're going to do is tell the truth and nothing but the truth in Black museums, because people demand it. Our communities demand it. And if we get something wrong, or they see that we're shying away from something, trust and believe that the people who are supporting our museums are going to bring that to the forefront to say that, hey, you missed this. Hey, I don't know if you know this, but it sounded like you were trying to be safe in this regard. You need to say it louder, you know? So if you're
going to- That's called accountability and relationship, isn't it, doctor?
It absolutely is. And we
I would be remiss. I want people to be able to find you all.
Yeah.
Do I have the website right? Blackmuseums.org.
Yes, that is us.
And folks, we're all evolving. I know they're developing new pages and new sites. And I'm mindful of something. You know, Black museums tell the story of migration and immigration. And perhaps families, given that we're simmering down from the pandemic. It isn't over, but we're simmering down. In the meantime, your organization cooperates with TripAdvisor.com and look for the ultimate list of African-American museums at TripAdvisor.com. And again, AAAM's website is blackmuseums with an S .org. Doctor, we have to exit. So I'm going to thank Dr. Vidette Coleman Robinson, President and CEO of the Association of African American Museums. Thank you for talking with us this morning. Doctor, you have the last word with.
Thank you, David. And I just thank you for this programming. You know, this is everything that everybody needs. And thank you for your listeners. And thank you for learning a little bit more about AAAM and being with us this year. I appreciate you a great deal.
Are you most welcome. All the best. Coming up next is the news. My thanks to Katia Stitt and Kalia Chapman for engineering. Take good care. Perhaps we'll meet again soon.
Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. Vice presidential nominees Republican Ohio Senator J.D. Vance and Democratic Minnesota Governor Tim Walz held their first and possibly only debate this election year last night. Rather than attacking each other, the two running mates targeted the top of their rival tickets, Democrat Kamala Harris and Republican Donald Trump. Catherine Carley reports.
I don't want people who are struggling with addiction to be deprived of their second chance because Kamala Harris let in fentanyl into our communities at record levels.
In the vice presidential debate, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance says he and former President Donald Trump would empower border agents to stop drug trafficking and illegal immigration. Vance blamed immigrants for many problems, from guns to a housing shortage, but he did not say whether he would support Trump's family separation policy. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz didn't attack Vance for spreading the conspiracy theory that Haitian migrants are eating pets, but he did repeatedly point to Trump killing a tough bipartisan immigration bill that would have hired 1,500 border agents.
We fixed this issue with a bill that is necessary, but the issue on this is what happens when you don't want to solve it. You demonize it.
In a mostly respectful and policy-heavy 90 minutes, the two clashed on abortion, child care, January 6th, and the economy. In style, Vance, a Yale-trained lawyer, was smoothly articulate. Walz, the former small-town teacher, was more folksy, at one point calling himself a knucklehead. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Last night's debate could be the last debate of the presidential election as Donald Trump is backed out of a 60 Minutes election interview that Kamala Harris will participate in, according to the program. Iran launched at least 180 missiles at Israel that in part targeted air bases and Mossad headquarters, according to the Tehran Times. Images show craters from strikes in Israel and an unknown number of destroyed fighter jets. Also hit a school and a restaurant. restaurant. Israel says the attack failed, that it intercepted most of the missiles. President Joe Biden doubled down U.S. support for Israel, saying forces in the Middle East supported Israel's defenses.
At my direction, the United States military actively supported the defense of Israel, and we're still assessing the impact. But based on what we know now, the attack appears to have been defeated and ineffective. And this is testament to Israeli military capability and U.S. military. It's also a testament to intensive planning between the United States and Israel to anticipate and defend against the brazen attack we expected. Make no mistake, the United States is fully supportive of Israel.
The Pentagon says it deployed about a dozen interceptors. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is now vowing to retaliate against Iran, saying Tehran will pay. And Iranian commanders threatening wider strikes if Israel retaliates. Iran's president says Israel will face a stronger response than Tuesday's missile strikes. The United Nations Security Council's called an emergency meeting today to address the spiraling conflict. Meanwhile, Israel's foreign minister has banned UN Chief Antonio Guterres from entering the country, accusing him of anti-Israel bias. That move criticized by Germany. In Lebanon, Israel's military is warning people to evacuate another 24 villages in the south, a day after evacuating nearly 30 villages. Quds News is reporting Hezbollah's announced an ambush of an Israeli force. Israel's announced its first combat death. Israel says its ramped up military operation in southern Lebanon have destroyed over 150 terror infrastructures, including Hezbollah headquarters, weapons storage facilities, and rocket launchers. In southern Gaza, an Israeli ground offensive and air strikes killed at least 51 Palestinians, including children. Israel's continued to strike what it says are militant targets across the Gaza Strip, nearly a year after Hamas's October 7th massacre that ignited the war in Palestine. On Tuesday, the U.S. imposed sanctions on Hilltop Youth, a group of extremist settlers in the Israeli-occupied West Bank who attack Palestinians and their property. The sanctions also targeted two Israeli men connected to violence against Palestinians. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller said the actions of these individuals have contributed to creating an environment where violence and instability thrive. He also said it undermines peace, security, and stability in the West Bank. I'm Christina Onnestead, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
WPFW, Washington.
This land is no one's land. This land is your burying ground. I wonder why they're fighting over this land. God made this war. Everything is in. Men against men. They fighting over this land. This land. No one land, no, yeah. God made this world, everybody equal, but they fighting. Both day and night. killing each other over this land. This the burying ground. I don't know why the people getting out of hand. This land, no one land, oh no. Thing within, he didn't make it for one man, he made it for everyone. I don't know why they're fighting over the burying ground. The land they walk on is the burying ground.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Yours truly, the cowboy, sitting in for my brother in the blues, Clarence the Blues Man, Turner. Yeah, right. Now, I came in here, man, to play the blues. I could have brought up, actually, I could have stayed on this one CD for the whole show, but I'm not going to do that to you. I'm always loaded for bear, though. That is the absolute truth about it. Before we get into it, let me make a reference. Now, I was listening to the show before, and I really enjoyed that a whole lot. Yeah, right. And the guest made reference to, I guess, someone who came to a museum or whatever and said that, you know, back in the day or what have you, so-and-so and so-and-so would have been my slave or your slave or what have you. And that reminded me of when I was like in the fourth grade down in Walla, Texas. And I remember a social studies teacher made the exact same statement. Yeah, right. Now, I'm in like the fourth grade, so she makes this statement to a child who was sitting in front of me in class. And then she made the mistake of letting us go to the restroom right after she made that, and he repeated it in the bathroom. He was lucky to make it back to class. Now, I understood what she said, and she said, well, I let that thing go. I was in the fourth grade. I wasn't there yet. I don't know that I'm there now. So don't try me. Yes, you're right. We're going to play the blues this afternoon. I got a few things that I want to do, but let's see where the spirit takes me.
The late show is over. And the city's fast asleep. And I'm lost in a world that's just too cold and deep. I've turned so many ways. I'm spinning like a tower. And I wish that I could get off. Or get this world to stop. I'm a stranger and a freak. I'm a stranger and a freak. I'm a stranger and a freak in a world I never. I'm always chasing dragon. With a soul that's made of tin. So I know in my soul there's no way I can win. I try, ooh, I try. But there's no place I. There's no one here who knows me. All right. And no one here I know. I'm a stranger and a freak. I'm a stranger and a freak. I'm a stranger and a freak in a world I never meet.
Ain't that the truth, Dr. John? Stranger, world I never made. Yeah, right. Lest I forget, at around 12:35, my dear sister, Robin Holden, will call in to share with you all the exciting news. Yes, you're right, about the reggae fundraiser that's coming up on this Saturday. So around 12:35, look forward to listening to myself and my sister, Robin Holden, chop it up just a little bit, yeah, right, about the reggae concert. It's going to be awesome. And I know you want to be in the house, and Robin is intending to make sure that you are there. So you stay with us here. Let's keep on rolling. Why not?
Trouble taking place in the lowlands at night. I woke up this morning, couldn't even get out of my door. I woke up this morning, couldn't even get out of my door. Enough trouble to make a poor woman wonder where she's gonna go. about 5 miles across the pond. Say they rowed a little boat about 5 miles across the pond. I packed up all my clothes, rode them in, and they rowed me along. Well, it thundered and lightning, and the winds began to blow. Said it thundered and lightning, and the winds began to blow. There was thousands of people, they had no place to go.
Sister, my Auntie Irma, yes, you're right, Backwater Blues. I called a friend this morning. Well, I sent him a text, yeah, you're right, this morning, a friend of mine down in Wilmington, North Carolina, to check on them and see how they were doing and see if the storm impacted them at all. And luckily, just about everybody that I've contacted from Florida on up that I know personally were not affected, thank God. Yeah, you're right. But in my message to them, and I asked them how they were doing and everything, and they kind of told me that, then they went on a tirade that I'm not going to deal with right now. But they mentioned to me that they don't watch television. And I don't know if they listen to the radio or not, but they weren't aware of the intensity of the devastation in the western part of North Carolina and in Georgia and different places, right? And that just kind of took me back. I've had conversations, and I'm sure that you have too, with people who say they don't watch TV. I don't know how to respond to that. I don't know. You can read the newspaper, and I advocate reading. It's fundamental, sure enough. But you can't get the news fast enough in a newspaper. And it just kind of took me. And I was listening to an interview this morning with a public radio station in Asheville, North Carolina. And essentially, for a lot of people in that area that were impacted by Helene, that was their only contact with the outside world, was this public radio station. And I'm saying that to say that we never know when we're going to be impacted like they're hit there. And this WPFW may be, yeah, you're right, your contact with the outside world. So you surely want us to be here for you, because we sure enough here for you. Let's lift up my homeboy. He would have celebrated a birthday on Tabar, born in 1954 in Dallas, Texas. Stevie Ray, happy birthday. Thank you. Happy heavenly birthday, Stevie Ray Vaughan. Let's go to another one of those Texas gunslingers who would have celebrated a birthday on yesterday, born in 1932 in Leona, Texas. The Iceman, Albert Collins. Happy birthday to you. Enough. Well, I'm on a roll now. Let's get one more birthday in. Yeah, right. Don't forget it. Around 12:35, we're going to hear from my dear sister, Robin Holden, is going to call in. Yes, you're right. To encourage you, indeed, to make it to King Solomon's Lodge on this Saturday. Yeah, right. For the reggae fundraiser. Yes, indeed. It's going to be a blast. Sure enough. You might well get ready for that one. You know, Robin don't have do nothing. You know that. It's going to be a party show enough. Yeah, right. Let's pick up this birthday artist. You know I like that Hammond B3. We missed his birthday on September the 17th. Born in 1926 in Champaign, Illinois. One of my favorites, show enough. Jack McDuff, happy birthday to you, my friend. Thank you.
We'll be right back.